Here's another message from Life Christian Church.
We're going to continue with that focus on prayer. And let me say right up front that if there's any topic I feel less qualified to speak on, it's the topic of prayer. I always feel that I could pray more, that I could pray more fervently. And so we're learners together in this. We really are. I haven't got this all together. We're learning together. And I'm hoping this morning that we can learn from the example of a wonderful prayer. In fact, this woman deserves to be mentioned among the greatest of the Old Testament saints. And her name is Hannah. And so I'd like you to turn your attention to the screen behind me if you haven't got your Bibles. 1 Samuel chapter 1, sorry. 1 Samuel chapter 1. Okay. There was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Zophite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephraimite. He had two wives. One was called Hannah and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man Elkanah went from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her and the Lord had closed her womb. And because the Lord had closed her womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her until she wept and would not eat. Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons?" He's kidding himself, isn't he, ladies? "Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons?" Once when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's temple. In bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. And she made a vow saying, "O Lord Almighty, if you'll only look upon your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but a voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk, and he said to her, "How long will you keep on getting drunk? Get rid of your wine." "Not so, my Lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I've not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my heart to the Lord. Do not take your servant as a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favour in your eyes." Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Early the next morning they arose and worshipped before the Lord, and then went back to their home at Ramah. Elkanah lay with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked the Lord for him." When the man Elkanah went up with his family to offer the annual sacrifice to the Lord and to fulfill his vow, Hannah did not go. She said to her husband, "After the boy is weaned, I will take him and present him before the Lord, and he will live there always." "Do what seems best to you," Elkanah, her husband, told her. "Stay here until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord make good his word." So the woman stayed at home and nursed her son until he was weaned. After he was weaned, she took the boy with her, as young as he was, along with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. When they had slaughtered the bull, they brought the boy to Eli, and she said to him, "As surely as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I ask of him. So now I give him to the Lord for his whole life. He will be given over to the Lord." And he worshipped the Lord there. Excuse me, I'm just going to raise this. This one. Okay. I've got a story here of a bricklayer. Now, this bricklayer, this brickie, was injured on the job. And this is the letter that this brickie sent to his employer requesting sick leave. Now, this story's done the rounds over the years, so much so that this actually appeared on, you know, the TV show Mythbusters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic show. This actually appeared on Mythbusters, and this is this bricklayer's story. Heard on the job requesting sick leave, this is his letter. I arrived at the job after the storm, checked the building out, and saw that the top needed repairs. I rigged a hoist and a boom, attached the rope to a barrel and pulled bricks to the top, and I secured the rope at the bottom. After repairing the building, I went back to fill the barrel with the leftover bricks. I then went down and released the rope to lower the bricks, and the barrel was heavier than I and jerked me off the ground. Now, this is where his problems start. Okay, he's down here, he's released the rope, and the barrel full of bricks was heavier than him, and it's jerked him off the ground. He continues, I decided to hang on. Bad move, bro. I decided to hang on. Halfway up, I met the barrel coming down and received a blow to my shoulder. I hung on and went to the top, where I hit my head on the boom and caught my fingers in the pulley. In the meantime, the barrel hit the ground and burst open, throwing the bricks all over. This made the barrel lighter than I. And I started down at high speed. Halfway down, I met the barrel coming up. And I received cuts and bruises. At this time, I must have lost my presence of mind because I let go of the rope. And the barrel came down and hit me on the head. I respectfully request sick leave. Approved. I respectfully request sick leave. We've all had days like that. Well, probably not exactly like that. Don't know that there's anyone here who said, oh yeah, that happened to me the other day. We've all had bad days. We've all had bad periods of time. Times when trouble and suffering has just become too much to bear. And, you know, the question I want to ask this morning is, what do we do when those times come upon us? What do we do with troubles and suffering? Well, I'm going to ask the question, what did Hannah do? And what we're going to see as we look into this passage in these next few moments is that what Hannah did was a simple two-step process, and it brought such release and peace into her life. A simple two-step process. The first thing that Hannah did was that she quite simply gave her troubles to God. A very simple thing. She just gave her troubles to God. Now, we're introduced in verse 1 of this passage to a man by the name of Elkanah. Now, when someone is mentioned in the scriptures and they're given a lengthy genealogy, it's usually an indication that they're a person of some wealth or some status within their community. And conversely, if someone's given a very short genealogy, it's usually an indication that they're a person of more humble means. For example, we know that Joseph, the father of our Lord, was known quite simply as Joseph, son of David. Elkanah, on the other hand, is known here in verse 1 as Elkanah, son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. So it gives us the impression that Elkanah was a man of some means, some wealth. And in fact, that's confirmed a little bit later on in this passage. I think it's in verse 24, when we read that the offering that Elkanah brings to the Lord is a three-year-old bull. Now, this is a man with some resources. The scriptures tell us that if a person is too poor to bring an offering, that they can offer a dove or a pigeon. This is the offering of a man of wealth and status. So he's a wealthy man, he has some status, and that being the case, it's important for Elkanah to have a son who would become his heir and carry on the family name. The problem that we're introduced to here in this passage is that his wife Hannah was barren and unable to have children. But that necessarily wasn't a problem in these days. Elkanah simply took to himself a second wife, a lady by the name of Peninnah. Now, in a day when it was important for a man of some wealth and some status to have an heir to carry on the family name, and in a day, now this sounds offensive to our modern ears, but this was the way it was then. In a day when a woman's value was measured by her ability to have children, Hannah would have suffered greatly. But that suffering was increased year after year when the family made their way to Shiloh for this annual sacrifice. And in verses 3 through to 5, we read these things here. Year after year, this man Elkanah went up to his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. Now, just listen to this next verse. So he'd give portions to Peninnah and to all of her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her and the Lord had closed her womb. Does anyone have a different translation out there? Translation different to the NIV? Okay, if you've got a different translation, you might have a different translation of verse 5. For example, the RSV of verse 5 says this: although Elkanah loved Hannah, he would give Hannah only one portion because the Lord had closed her womb. So we have this discrepancy between the translations. Some say that Peninnah was given multiple portions, but Hannah a double portion. But some translations say Hannah only a single portion. Now, the reason for those differences in translation is because the Hebrew of that verse is just a little bit uncertain, and it's troubled translators over the years. And without getting into all of the detail of that, I tend to favour the RSV translation, which says that he would give Hannah only one portion of the sacrificial meat, for a very simple reason. Peninnah had herself and all of her children to feed, whereas Hannah, being barren and without children, only had herself to feed. And so she was only given that one portion of the sacrificial meat. And that one portion would have been a very stark and painful reminder year after year of her inability to provide her husband with an heir. But if that wasn't enough, we read that Peninnah, Elkanah's second wife, took this opportunity to score points over Hannah. And so in verses 6 and 7 we read, "Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival Peninnah kept provoking her in order to irritate her." This, listen to this, this went on year after year. "Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her until she wept and would not eat." I mean, what a horrible thing for Hannah to have to endure. You know, that reminder in that portion of her inability to provide her husband with an heir in a culture that valued that in a woman. She would have suffered greatly in that environment. And then her rival, Peninnah, kept provoking her year after year after year at this festival and just increased the grief and the anguish that she was feeling. And this was meant to be a time of celebration. This pilgrimage and this festival was meant to be a time when families came together. It was meant to be a time of great joy and great family celebration. But for Hannah, this was a hellish experience. And we read that it went on year after year after year. Now, you know, I can imagine in the lead up to this pilgrimage, there would have been a buzz within the community. You know, "Oh, you're going up to Shiloh?" And there would have been a buzz of excitement. And I reckon for Hannah, she would have been sitting at home thinking, "Oh, not again. It'll be like last year. It'll be like the year before that." And for Hannah, this was a terrible time. I mean, what do you do when your anguish and your grief is too much to bear? Well, again, Hannah simply gave it to God. Look in verse 9 through to 11. "Once when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh," so this was right after the provocation of Peninnah. "Once when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's temple. In bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. And she made a vow saying, O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son. Notice the prayers for a son, an heir to carry on that family name. And give her a son. Then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life. And no razor will ever be used on his head. That's just a reference to a Nazarite vow that we won't get into now. Hannah simply gave her troubles to God. I'm guessing that we've all got things in our past that we deeply regret doing. You know, things that we look back on and, you know, years down the track, decades down the track, you think to yourself, how could I have been so stupid to have done that? What got into me? You know, I certainly have those things in my life. This is not easy to say, but I once bought a Ford. Young and stupid, I know, but I once bought a Ford. I'm a Holden man. I love my Holdens. But there's two of us. My first car, in fact, it wasn't a Hilux. Who wants a Hilux? My first car was a Ford. It was a TC Cortina. Okay, we've got one Holden, one Ford. Okay, this is going to be a quick fight, I think. It was a TC Cortina, and it was a bomb. And I was forever fixing this thing. Now, I was 17. I knew nothing about cars, but I had no money to fix them. And when you buy a Ford and it's a bomb, you're fixing it all the time. In fact, when you buy a Ford, you're fixing it all the time. You know, no, 17 years old, no money. Whenever this thing broke down, I'd have a crack at fixing it myself. Now, usually I didn't know what I was doing, and it ended up with a bigger repair bill, but I'd have a crack at it anyway. There was one time there where the starter motor, the car wouldn't start. And I knew nothing about cars, but my mate Peter, who lived across the road, was a few years older than me and knew a fair bit about cars. And he said to me, oh, look, it's probably the brushes in your starter motor. All you've got to do is buy some new brushes, replace the brushes, and you'll be on your way. So I did. I went and bought some brushes, took the starter motor out, replaced the brushes, put the starter motor back in, and realised I had a problem. Because what I'd done was I'd unclipped the wires, the electrical wires, and I'd made no note of where those wires went. And so when I went to, the starter motor was no problem, that was quite simple, but when I put the starter motor back in, I had no idea where these three wires went. And to make matters worse, there were four pins that these three wires had to go onto. And so I started trying different combinations until I came up with something that appeared to work. And, you know, the starter motor would start the car, and I thought, oh, yeah, it's a bit whiny, but, you know, it starts the car, so it's working, that's good. So I took it for a five-minute test drive, and I reckon it was about 5 minutes down the road, and next minute, boom, up she goes. Apparently, when I put the car in for repairs, apparently what was happening was I'd wired it in such a fashion that the starter motor was engaging, but then not disengaging once the engine had started. And so it was engaged the whole time. And, you know, after 5 minutes of running, it just, you know, when I opened the bonnet, it was glowing red and smoking. So that ended up being a costly repair. But it didn't stop me trying to repair the car whenever it broke down. There was one occasion there, I won't regale you with stories of Fords, you know how trashy they are. But my passenger side rear door wouldn't open from the inside, and that frustrated the living daylights out of me. Everything's got to work properly. And so I thought I'd have a crack at fixing this. So, you know, I opened it up and I took the little armrest off and the window winder and the door skin. And as soon as I did that, I saw the reason why the door wasn't opening. There's a metal rod that would go from the door opening mechanism to the latch attachment thing on the door. So I'm not sounding very mechanical, am I? But it went from the door handle to the locking mechanism on the door, and it had a bend in it, and that's why it wasn't opening. And so I, you know, took that I tried to take that rod out. And I don't know if you've ever been inside the door, the cavity of a door before, but there's not a lot of space. And, you know, I'm in there and I've got these spanners and, you know, my fingers are slipping and I'm cutting them on bits of metal that are in there and windows and, you know, it's getting pretty horrible. And, you know, you're dropping nuts and you're dropping bolts and you're dropping washers and you're trying to get in there and recover those nuts and bolts and washers. Very, very frustrating job. Well, after about an hour, I eventually got this rod off and I was able to put it down on the ground and hammer it flat. And then I got it back into the car and another hour later, you know, fiddling with these nuts and bolts and scarring knuckles and everything, I got the rod on and shut the door and tried to open it and it still wouldn't open. Frustrating. So off it came again. And, you know, I tried something else and I tried something else. After hours and hours of trying to fix this jolly thing, I got so frustrated. I was 17 years old. I got so frustrated that I picked up the screwdriver and I threw it in anger at the car and it hit the pillar from the roof down to the rear guard. It hit that pillar, bounced back and hit me in the head. And, you know, I'm here with my hanky trying to stem the flow of blood. And my mate Peter across the street must have seen this and he came over. Now, I don't know how long he'd been watching for. But if I ever find out, it was for quite some time. Who knows what'll happen. But he came over and he said, "What's the problem?" "This stupid door. Look at my fingers." He says, "Let me have a look at it." I kid you not. 5 seconds later, he came back and said, "It's fixed." I said, "What do you mean? That's not, I've been here for 3 flipping hours. How can this possibly be fixed?" And he said the child lock was on. Oh. 17 years old, what do I know about child locks? The child lock was on. Frustrating. All of this running around and mucking around and acting like a pork chop and throwing screwdrivers at the car. And the answer was as simple as the child lock was on. It was right there in front of me all the time. Knucklehead. But hang on. We're all a bit knucklehead, aren't we? We have these situations that come into our lives. And again, I'll put my hand up, I'm guilty. We have these situations that come into our lives and they drive us to distraction. You know, we get frustrated, we get angry. Dare I even admit that we get angry with God? And, you know, we are driven to our wit's end. And the answer's right in front of us. You've just got to give those troubles over to God. It's what Hannah did. She got to the point where year after year after year, her suffering was just too great. She couldn't cope with it anymore. She simply gave her troubles over to God. Does that sound a little too simplistic? Yeah. Well, remember I said it's a two-step process. That's just the first step. There's another step, and this is the one I think we most have the problems with, because it's not enough to simply give your troubles to God. We've then got to make the very deliberate and very conscious decision not only to give our troubles to God, but to leave them with Him. And this is what we struggle with most. It's what I struggle with most. Give them to God, but leave them with Him. Sadly, Hannah lived in a day where few people sought God. It was a day where the book of Judges tells us that everyone did as he saw fit. In fact, just over a page here, we read in 1 Samuel chapter 3 that in those days the word of the Lord was rare and there were not many visions. And Pastor Peter finished with this verse last week in his message. This was the context in which Hannah was living out her faith. The spiritual life of Israel was in decline. Few people sought God. The word of the Lord was rare. Not many visions. And fervent prayer and devotion was very, very rare. That's why when Eli saw Hannah praying, he didn't realize she was praying. And he said to her in verse 14, "How long will you keep on getting drunk? Get rid of your wine." He thought she was drunk. The life, spiritual life of Israel had declined so much that even the priest of God could not recognize a spiritual woman. This, again, is the context in which Hannah was living out her faith. And when Eli realized his mistake, he sent Hannah away with his blessing. and with the prayer that God would grant her the petition that she requested of God. Now, what amazes me about Hannah's situation is the way that she left that place of prayer. Back in verse 7, before entering that place of prayer, when she was being provoked by Peninnah, in verse 7 we read, "This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her until she wept and would not eat." So going into that place of prayer, she was weeping and unable to eat. Verse 18 now, coming out of that place of prayer, we read, "Then Hannah went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast." So verse 7, weeping and not eating. Verse 18, after she'd given her troubles over to God, we find her eating and not weeping. Weeping and not eating, eating and not weeping. Hannah was a changed person. Changed not only because she'd given her troubles to God, but because she'd made the very deliberate and conscious decision to leave them with him and trusting him with the outcome. And let's face it, Hannah had no idea what the outcome of this would be. We read in the next chapter of 1 Samuel chapter 2 that God blessed Hannah's socks off. He gave her three sons and two daughters. Three sons and two daughters. But Hannah, leaving that place of prayer, Hannah had no insight into what the future held for her. But she'd made the deliberate and conscious decision that she was not only going to give her troubles to God, she was going to leave them with him. And in that action, in that decision, she found peace. And she was able to go away and eat and no longer be downcast. Thanks, Bev. If you don't mind just putting that image up now, thanks. The one of the solar system. I'm often astounded by the dimensions of space, the dimensions of our cosmos. Did anyone get up the other week to see that solar, that lunar eclipse? Yeah, spectacular, you know. Just amazing. God is such a creative God. And I don't know how that went down. I can imagine that before the beginning of time, before the creation of the universe, I can just imagine God sitting down with the Son and the Holy Spirit and saying, you know, I'm going to arrange the Earth and the Sun and the Moon and their orbits so that it produces this spectacular show. And, I can imagine the God the Son and God the Holy Spirit going, yeah, that'll blow their socks off. And, you know, thousands of years later, here we are looking up at the night sky, watching this spectacle that God had put into play. Just what a creative God we have. Spectacular. But I'm astounded at the dimensions of space. Now, there we have our sun, we have our nine planets. I've included Pluto. Pluto fell out of favour as a planet a few years ago. I think he's back in favour, is he? No, he's still out of favour? Okay. Well, I've included him. I like him. He was my favourite Disney character. Okay. So Pluto's up there as well. Listen to this. These are the dimensions of space. Just our solar system we're talking about here. From the sun to Pluto is 5.9 billion kilometres. 5.9 billion kilometres. I can't get my head around a number like that, around a distance like that. It's just not able to go there. 5.9 billion kilometres from the sun to Pluto. Now, let's give that some context. Let's give it some definition. If you were to drive a car from the edge of the sun out to Pluto, now, if you were to drive that at highway speeds, you know, about 100 k's an hour, 110 k's an hour, it would take you more than 6,000 years to get there. That's how great that distance is. If you would allow a bit longer for a Ford, so from the hundreds of years, from the sun right out to Pluto at 100 kilometres an hour, more than 6,000 years. Now, I haven't run the math on this. I've done some research. I haven't run the math to check this, but I'm trusting my sources. My source here is Dr. Google, well-known professor of mathematics, so I'm trusting that this is right. But 6,000 years to go from the sun to Pluto. Now, the most staggering thing about this is that Pluto is not actually the edge of our solar system. The solar system extends beyond the planets. In fact, if you were to drive that same car at that same speed from the sun to the edge of the solar system, it would take not 6,000 years, but 19... You're thinking I'm going to say 19,000. No, 19 million years. 19 million years to drive a car at 100 kilometres an hour from the sun to the very edge of the solar system. That's mind-blowing. Again, I can't get my head around those distances. In fact, Dr. Google told me that the NASA New Horizons spacecraft, which is reputed to be the fastest thing ever launched from Earth, even that thing would take 37,000 years to get from the sun to the edge of the solar system. That's just crazy. But let's think even a little bit more ridiculously. Thanks, Bev. The next image. Our Milky Way galaxy. Our solar system appears within the Milky Way galaxy. So this solar system that would take 19 million years to travel from the sun to the edge of fits within that Milky Way galaxy. Now, we can't even see it because on that picture it would only appear as a dot. This huge big solar system is just a dot within our galaxy. In fact, our solar system is only 0.0032% the size of our galaxy. Are you beginning to get a picture of a great and mighty and awesome and powerful God? This is unbelievable. What and how stunning is our galaxy? That is stunning. But this is the God that we have. I love what the psalmist says, King David in Psalm 8, when thinking of all of this stuff. In Psalm 8, King David says this: "When I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you've set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him?" And I love that imagery. You know, when I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers. You know, God commands into being a planet and then pushes it into place with his finger. You know, he commands into being a solar system and pushes it into place with his finger. A galaxy and pushes it into place with his finger. Of course, that's poetic language. God is a spirit and doesn't have fingers. We call that an anthropomorphism. But it's this image of God. What David is saying in that psalm is that God is awesome and he's mighty and he's powerful and he pushes this stuff around with his fingers. He's just so strong, so powerful, so mighty. And what I want to say is this: you know, when we have a circumstance in our life that we find overpowering and overbearing, and we get to that point where we just can't take it anymore, when we give that to God, and when we decide that we're going to leave that in his hands and trust him with the outcome, as Hannah did, when we get to that position, then, you know, God is able to deal with that. You know, this God that pushes galaxies around with his finger, he is able to deal with whatever it is that we bring his way. And we can confidently trust him. We can know that whatever we bring his way is not going to overwhelm him. It's not going to stump him. It's not going to leave him wondering how on earth he's going to handle this issue. God is well able to deal with whatever it is we lay in his lap and leave there. You know, the world, you know, the unbelieving community doesn't get this. It really doesn't get this. And, you know, an unbeliever might say something like this: that's weak. You're not going to do anything to help your situation. You're just going to give it to God. Let me say to you this morning, this is not a weak thing. There is nothing that you could do that could be stronger or braver than to give your troubles to God and leave them with him. This is not a passive thing. This is a very active thing. It involves giving your troubles to God, leaving them with him, and making that very deliberate and conscious decision and resolve to trust him with the outcome, whatever that outcome might be. You know, you might do that this morning. It will involve tomorrow morning waking up and saying, "God, I'm no longer wanting to be anxious. I'm no longer wanting to be scared. I'm going to trust you today. I'm not going to worry." It'll mean waking up on Tuesday. God, you're an awesome God. You're a star creator. You're a universe creator. And I'm going to trust you. I'm not going to fear. This is not something weak. This is something very, very active and very, very liberating. When we get to that point where we give it to God and leave it with him, trusting him with the outcome. I'm going to ask the team to come back and we'll wrap this up here. The final thing I want to say this morning is this. When you come to God in prayer and he answers your prayer, don't forget him. It's so easy to cry out to God in the storm and see miracles happen, but as soon as the storm is past, forget him. That's not what Hannah did. Hannah promised God that he would grant her a son, that she would give him back to the Lord for all the days of his life. And that's exactly what Hannah did. Verse 24, when she had weaned the boy, she took him with her, young as he was, along with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. When they had slaughtered the bull, they brought the boy to Eli, and she said to him, as surely as you live, my Lord, I'm the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life he will be given over to the Lord. And he worshipped the Lord there. Hannah did not forget God. She came back with her praise and with her thanks. This would not have been easy for Hannah. This was the child that she longed for year in, year out. Children in this day were weaned about the age of three. She'd nursed this child for 3 years and formed that bond with that child that only a mother understands. And she gave that child up knowing that she would see him once a year when the family went back to Shiloh. But God had been good to her, and she did not forget that. If God's good to you, don't forget him. You might be here this morning. You might be burdened. You might be feeling downtrodden. You can leave here this morning as Hannah did, eating and not weeping, at peace with your circumstances. But it will involve these two simple steps, giving your troubles to God and leaving them with him, trusting him with the outcome.